recognize her for inviting me. In this case, I'm living outside to this field, and it's a pleasure to be here and to learn a lot and maybe get some colorful remarks at the end. Even my distance from this place, I'm also the outlier, because I came from very far. And as already implied, it's really a joint work of a few people. Let's see which one. Sassolan is our graduate student, that was his PhD thesis. And my collaborators are Ethan Lupin and Shimon Edelman. Now, since the tradition of this place is kind of interdisciplinary, let me say that I am a physicist. At least my education, most of my career was in high energy physics before turning to more computation and other fields. Ethan Lupin is a medical doctor and a computer scientist. And Shimon Edelman's education was in electrical engineering and computer scientist. He's now professor of psychology at Cornell. And this whole thing started about 5 years ago when Ethan and Shimon were together at the NIPS conference, and then we decided maybe time has come to try to get grammar out of data in some very rudimentary fashion, or you will see what I mean. And it took us some time to develop our intuition. And at first, I thought that we were really looking for a space in which language exists. But then I realized, no, it's not a space. And all our efforts to put it into space were futile, but we took a graph attitude. That's why I commented about looking at the graph rather than at the space. So this paper is on grammar induction, but there is an element of it which is motif extraction or pattern extraction from the data, which is very important by itself, and therefore I put it as an independent element. And it is this element that so far was also most useful in our applications in biology, and I'll show you some of them. So motif extraction and grammar induction, and the whole point that we are very proud of is that we do it in an unsupervised manner. So you are given a corpus of strings, and can be text, can be transcribed speech, can be biological strings, and this algorithm has two parts. One of it makes is to find motifs in the data, and the other is to distill some structure, which is in fact grammar, and it will end up as a context-free grammar representation of the corpus at hand. And this is just in a pictorial way saying the same thing. So we either look at natural language text, we can look at transcribed speech. There are, in fact, students who have applied it to music. We did apply it to DNA sequences and to protein sequences. And protein sequences are actually much more successful than DNA sequences, but I'll say a little bit about it. And all these data, in fact, have one thing in common. They are one-dimensional. And they are a one-dimensional representation of some reality. And to have a one-dimensional representation of reality, say in language or in biological data, then you have to have this one-dimensional thing have some rule. That is where the syntax comes in. And it's actually the syntax that we will look for. And then there's also semantics, namely connecting whatever it is that you read in this one dimension to real life. Be it real life in language, where it is kind of the meaning, or be it real life in biology, where it is carrying out a function of the biological purpose for which this exists, or if you wish, not necessarily a purpose, but the effect of this in biology. Well, we will talk about the syntactic structure, but some of the semantics will come out. So rather than describing first the algorithm, let me first say what I will do with it. And as an example, I would like to start with a toy problem. This toy problem is what you can see here is the first paragraph from Alice in Wonderland, written in such a way as to disguise the words as much as possible, namely only lowercase letters, no intervals, whatever. And now the problem is, or the task is, to find the words in here. And the algorithm, what it does, is takes into account, of course, not only this first paragraph of Alice in Wonderland, but takes into account all paragraphs of Alice in Wonderland. So 800-something paragraphs of Alice in Wonderland. And then we use this data. And we put this data on a graph, so one paragraph after the other. And then the question is whether from the structure that we see in this graph, if we can extract from it things that have the tendency to appear, letters that have the tendency to appear together. So that here is a description of what it is. We create a graph. The graph has vertices. The vertices in this case are the letters. Now we don't start by telling you what the edges are. Instead, what we do is we take these paragraphs or sentences and we load them onto the graph as a string of letters. So each such paragraph, well, I thought it would automatically give me the previous one, but that doesn't work. So never mind. So each such paragraph will be a path on the lattice. We use the word path. It will be a path. We'll add a begin and end, and then it will cross through the various letters of the alphabet, each of one is a vertex on the lattice. Then we take all these paths, and we walk along them, and we see if there is structure that occurs on these paths. So we will find structure like Alice was in here. But this is not because we do some statistical or global statistical estimate of whether it goes together in some way of a k-mer with k equals 7. Rather, we'll do it in a local manner as you will see. So we load the strings on the graph, and then given this loaded graph, we look at all the different paths and we see whether parts of them coincide with each other. So we get something that looks like, if you wish, a map of a subway system. Okay? And along lines where, or along sections where lines merge, this is kind of our indication that there is something important going on, something significant of that particular path of these strings, and that will be what we consider a motif or a pattern.
Are you going to explain the whole thing in detail?
Okay, it will be most.
So far, I think what you said is repeated substrings are important. Is that right? So far.
Yes, but okay. They are repeated not just because of global statistics, but because of conditions that will appear at the end and at the beginning of each substring.
Well, if they have this, okay, so you're saying that if the appears a lot between of and cat, then the might be important.
No, I will explain what I mean in a second.
Thanks.
So this is an example of a random graph and a structured graph. So the idea is that here in the structured graph, we will see a few of these paths going together along some subsection, and this 14, 15, 5 may turn out to be a motif. So, how does it work? So here we go. So this is, we start with the first paragraph. We load it onto our graph. So we start with Alice, etc. And then say we take a second paragraph, or in fact also the continuation of the first paragraph. And now we have a W that wasn't before, so here it is. And then the H and the E, and okay, the he existed already. So things that exist already, we repeat over them. So this is a multigraph or whatever it is called. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so we continue, and this is putting the second paragraph on it, and in fact the continuation of the first paragraph will be of the same type. Only so we have 26 vertices and a lot of paths.
So at the end of this thing, you'll have 26 vertices and a lot of paths.
And a lot
Thank
of
you.
Paths.
Thank you.
So how
and
about
then our what we want is to find Alice as a word
okay.
in this jungle. Okay.
So I think the big question is, suppose ALI appears as a substring
mm-hmm.
In some other context, like Muhammad Ali,
no.
And LIC appears as a substring
no.
in some other context, and ICE appears as a substring.
Right. So
does
after,
that count in favor of Alice?
After extracting Alice, we may find Muhammad Ali, but since the author of Alice is one of them, didn't know about him. So presumably Ali does not appear as a motif. The question is,
we found Ali first.
No, we'll go with the longer ones first.
Okay, so I mean the way you're drawing it as a graph seems a little misleading because it suggests that you're creating paths. You've added a lot of edges and that makes other paths spring into existence that mix and match. But in fact, your paths are not unions of edges, they're substrings.
Well,
in other words, when you add a path to the graph, you're not really adding all the edges, you're just adding the path.
I
so it's not really
paths.
A graph.
I
yeah.
just add paths,
right?
Right. But these paths are labeled, and I can reconstruct where I am.
So there are colored threads, and each thread has a
colored
color,
threads.
So you
right.
can see exactly where
right.
you can't get
all
the threads.
Here is colored threads. Now here I show the logic. So we go along that path, say Alice. Alice was beginning, that's the beginning of the thing. Okay, there are 8,770 A's in these, okay, in this graph, but there are 1,000 times that L follows A, and there are 468 times that I follows L A. This is your Ali, and then there are 397 times where C follows it. But once A L I C is given, then E is the only possibility. But after that, you see it drops considerably because obviously Alice can continue in different ways, not just with the word was, and it is this drop that we are playing on. Namely, we ask when there is a discontinuity of this type. And this is the analysis we will do. So first we take all these paths and convert them into probabilities. So the way to do it, well, these are experimental probabilities if you wish, so there is no probabilistic model behind that, but just reading the data and converting the data into probabilities by just counting how many paths have continued. So you see the probability of getting to C2 after you started from C1 is 3/4, you can count it. And then following that with C3 and following that with C4, this is the type of probabilities that we calculate. And then we convert these paths into conditional probabilities. So we start with the probability of A being what it is, probability of L given A, etc. So eventually, you see that the type of probability that we get here after at the end of L is end up being 1. Why 1? Because once you have ALIC, then E is the only way it continues. But after that, the probability of continuing with W after Alice is much smaller. Because after Alice, you can continue in different ways. So we define this function, which we call right-handed probability, a right-moving probability, that has a starting point, and then it continues, and you see it increases, and at this point it decreases. And it is this decrease that we will play on to define what will be for us the end of our motif. And here you have the table of the probabilities. You see Alice does it, ends here. And here say the word was has a jump from 0.6 to 0.027. Eventually the probability reaches 1. It reaches 1 just because given a string of this length, it appears only this way in the whole corpus and the four, you get one at the end. You can define a probability matrix. So this is really a variable order Markov chain. But the order that we go, I mean, it keeps increasing as we go along. And say the type of numbers that I showed you there, starting from some point and then continuing up to k elements. And you can go also back. In fact, never mind that you write it from left to right, you can look at the whole process also the other way around, because the paths are given. You can talk about the condition probability going backwards, so you have the right moving and the left moving probability numbers or probability functions, and you can calculate them in the form of a matrix of that type. And this matrix that we will work with,
I'm sorry, sir,
looking
what
for
was
this continuum.
What was k?
K is just going k steps.
Right.
And it's arbitrary, okay?
Okay?
We continue going until we see something, until we find the drop.
Let me ask a clarifying question. So that element P of C1 given C2,
yeah,
that's what you meant by saying backward. I mean,
backwards.
The way that was calculated was that you looked at all
right.
the strings backwards,
right?
And you did the same kind of calculation, the incoming flow,
exactly.
dividing the through going, moving flow.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
The conditional probabilities are just what they appear to be.
Yeah. So here you have it in colors, with a different color specifying in each string. So and there are also numbers. So these say the path 1, and the path 2, and the path 3, 4, etc. And now we walk along the path 1, and we see the other paths coming in and moving out. And we look for a convergence like that into the world wars, and for a divergence like that out of the world wars. And the right moving probabilities and the left moving probabilities define this matrix that I showed you before. And we look at a drop of a probability, namely, what happens as we go along this path, what happens at the next letter, when we ask ourselves whether the probability at the next step is significantly smaller than the probability before. This is the type of condition that we incorporate in our algorithm. So what usually happens is that the probability keeps increasing and then it decreases at some point. And then we ask ourselves, is this decrease significant? And in fact, we have two parameters in our model. One is this eta that kind of requires the probability at the next step to be smaller than before, say 0.9. And then there is an alpha, which is kind of a p-value, of a distribution, asking ourselves, given the number of paths that we count, is this value significant or not? And this is the way the matrix looks in Alice. I showed you before the numbers, and here it is in a color code. And what happens is, if you walk enough, either to the right or to the left, you get the value 1, namely it's the only path seen in the text, but in between, in this valley, in between here, you look for elements that show some significant beginning or end of a motif. So basically the algorithm is load all the paths onto the graph, define this matrix of probabilities, find candidates for beginning and endpoints of motif, check their significance, and rewire the graph. Rewire the graph means I found a pattern or a motif, I introduce it now as a new element. So in addition to the 26 letters, I may have the word Alice was over there. And this way the graph may change. I can repeat the action. I can not repeat the action, it's up to me now. But this is a part of the rewiring is a part of the next step of the algorithm, namely Alice.
Okay.
Now, so, yeah.
Sir, so when you were writing the graph and you have a sentence, say, containing Alice, which was the first motif that you found, what happens to that path? It goes through Alice and A-L-I-C-E, or?
Okay, so here you have it in a pictorial manner, okay? So E2, E3, E4 were defined as a new pattern or a new motif.
Okay.
Now, this particular pattern or motif appears now as a point, as a new vertex on the graph. Now, this vertex includes 2, 3, 4 in this order. However, you have this path number 3 going to 2 and 3, which is not included in 2, 3, 4. Hence, 2 and 3 are left in the graph, and the path going through them. Everything else is kind of subsumed in P.
Okay.
I'm still not sure if the path containing Alice goes through P only or also through E2 and E3.
Goes through P only.
It goes through P only, but P includes in it the information that 2, 3, 4 are in it. It will eventually be represented as a tree, and then it will answer your question.
Well, a path containing only L, I, and then something else, or it goes through E2 and E3 that you have.
Right, so this would be kind of the analog of the 2-3.
So one benefit of removing Alice from those paths is that now you can decide, now you can realize that ice is a word, because
right.
It's no longer projecting AL will be before it,
because
Alice shows up many, many times in this document.
Yeah, okay, we will soon see some of these words and then it will be clearer, yeah. Okay? So here is an example of applying it once with some parameters and set of words coming out, yes.
So if you have identified Alice as a motif, then you can also later figure out that ice is a motif, and you can also go hierarchically and figure out that Alice and another motif is a high-level motif. But supposing that you erroneously decided that Alice was a motif, do you have any way of recovering from that erroneous decision and splitting Alice was?
As you will see, or as you can already see, the algorithm, the way it is described, is a greedy algorithm. And it's really some order dependent. And what will happen in the future, in about half an hour, after I introduce also the grammars, and in order to overcome different idiosyncrasies that come about from reading it in one way, we will change orders and have different learners. And then different learners may compensate for each other if there are mistakes of some kind.
At least the way you've described it so far, it is possible to extract Alice was as one motif, Alice as another motif,
correct.
And was as a third motif.
Correct. So here it is applying one value of parameters, and here is another example where we applied iteratively. So we start with a very small p-value, so it's a very string kind of condition, and you see it extracts Alice was separately, but there are various letters that it does not combine, and then you work on that, okay? So now you have, in addition to letters, you have now patterns, which are Alice, was, begin, etc., okay? And then you apply to this the same algorithm, and you have more things tying in, and then you apply it again with a higher alpha value, etc. So eventually you end up with something which includes not words, but in fact collocations of words, and this is the structure that you find. But you may stop anywhere in between if you wish, and you have even a single application of max gives you some sort of motifs that you find in the data. So this is just to illustrate what is being done, but let me now go to our first application, which is in biology. And the reason I start with Alice is Alice we can read and biology we can't. Yes, please.
Before you move on, so have you evaluated this?
Yes, but there are various ways of evaluating it. And, well, one way kind of at the end is to decide what type of errors we have in the following sense. Namely, there are various intervals that are left. And the question is how many of these intervals are wrong? And we separate.
What does it mean to be right or wrong?
Spaces which Say you have the word.
So you're trying to discover words.
I try to discover words or combination of words. Okay. And I call errors the case where there are letters that did not combine into words.
However, the use of would be considered as correct.
The use of would be considered as correct. But
even though it doesn't correspond to a grammatical constituent. So you said before you were trying to learn grammar is why I'm asking.
No, this is not grammar yet.
Yeah, okay.
But our type of grammar would be also that type. It's
so how does this compare to other techniques that have been used on this problem?
So there is an algorithm of about 10 years ago that was applied to this particular problem. And in fact, it was based on entropy, on reducing entropy. And we do as well and slightly better.
Who's on the bargain?
Guy from Rockefeller.
Eric C.J. I
think that's compared against Brent?
No.
There are also many papers, I would guess 100 papers, that try to solve this problem for Chinese because it's written without spaces traditionally.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll be happy to learn more about this paper and we'll do the comparison. But that particular thing of Alice, we didn't publish it because we were, in fact, because of that, because we wanted to confront it with other approaches, and we were familiar only with one. Now, in the application to biology, what we did, and that was presented in the conference last summer, we take sequences of enzymes, and we try to see whether in these enzymes we find motifs, namely strings of amino acids, and if these motifs have also some meaning, which by meaning I mean now a functional meaning. So here you have an example of an enzyme. You have its number, and you have a classification, a functional classification. I'll explain this in a minute. So here is the enzyme written in terms of the 20 letters that specify the amino acids. And the motifs that we find are indicated in blue. And we apply it to a set of 6,600 enzymes in this case. And we get all these particular or specific subsequences or specific strings. And then we do the following exercise. We view the enzyme as a bag of motifs. In other words, we represent it as a vector in a space spanned by these particular motifs. And we ask ourselves whether this type of representation has a functional meaning. We start out with 1,200 motifs. They cover 3,700 enzymes, meaning there are some enzymes on which none of these motifs appear, and they are not used now in the classification task.
So you applied the previous algorithm to these, and the things you show us in blue, they were discovered to be motifs, and the others were just single characters. You did not find any motif.
Right. So we threw them out.
Okay. And so now each enzyme is represented only by the
motifs. By the bag of motifs. Okay. Now, enzyme classification, there exists an enzyme commission that decides on the classification in terms of a tree with four numbers. And here is an example. The first number is a family. There are about 10,000 of that type. These particular enzymes are then subclassified according to who is the electron donor and who is the electron receptor in that reaction facilitated by the enzyme. Eventually, it's a particular substrate, and that is a classification of the enzyme. And our method is, as I said, we have that particular description as a bag of motifs for each one of the enzymes. These are the numbers of these proteins. And we look at second level and third level subclasses of the functional classifications. There are 16 families of this type and 32 families of this type. And I guess I don't have to explain SVM here. We have a linear classifier, basically separating the space into two families, and we do it separately for each subclass, and we represent the results in terms of Jacquard score. So Jacquard score were introduced already on the first day of this meeting. So the two positive divided by two positive plus false positive plus two negatives. And the values that we obtain are very high. These are the type of values that we obtain. When I say very high, they are better than what you get by other means of reaching this classification. What are other means? There are other representations of the protein. So for instance, one paper looks at the protein as a vector in space defined by the physical and chemical properties of the amino acids and kind of analysis of the numbers. And they do definitely worse. Another method is a kind of the conventional method that says what you do is you calculate the kind of the edit distance between two sequences, and if there is a high similarity of the sequences, then you have the same type of functional classification. So we use a method like that, we ran it on our data. The results are similar, yet we obtain even better results with that. So we were very happy with these results, saying that it means that the motifs that we find are meaningful. Now, a few words about that. In fact, when we look at motifs of that type, we get motifs of all lengths, including all motifs of length 2, which obviously are meaningless because we just get all combinations of 20 squared. And we get many of the motifs of length 3, etc. When I say that we were more successful than others is by considering motifs of length 6 and onwards. So this is the type, we didn't really do feature extraction. Instead, we just made a choice of what lengths we use, and that was the basis of the success in the calculation. It also turns out that many of the motifs that we find are unique to a particular subclass or sub-subclass of these enzymes. So we really hit on motifs that have, that kind of tell the story of a particular sub-subclass. Now this is an upside, but it's also a downside because it also says that what we find is a result of homology. Homology is a way to say in biology that you have many sequences that are basically the same sequence. Now, why is that here? When you look at this particular database of enzymes, you find the same type of enzyme but in different species. And in different species, it has the same functional meaning. However, there are small differences between one and the other. Kind of small mutations, and you see these differences in the enzyme, but they are highly similar. So once there is this similarity, in a sense one can say, well, you could find the same thing by just the similarity of the enzyme. The point is that the motifs that we find are these sections of the similar enzymes that don't change at all throughout evolution. And they appear very strongly in these results. So that is as far as motif extraction goes, and let me now move to Werner induction. Now what we try to do in here, we start the same way. We represent a corpus, in that case of sentences, on a graph of, in that case, words. So now the vertices are words, not letters, but words. And we apply the same type of algorithm, max first to find some patterns. But then we have a way to do some recursive generalization, and I will explain what we do in a minute. So our purpose is to get something which is computationally viable. Somehow, I don't know if it's really theoretically sound, but at least it should be, it should prove itself. So the proof is the type of accuracy that we get in our results. Now, ideas of that kind that we will employ were actually brought forward a long time ago. Harris, 1954, already wrote something of that type. Only at that time, the computational power that is needed to do the exercise that I will describe obviously did not exist. So we start out the same way as before. We take our graph. The graph has vertices, which are all the elements in the vocabulary. And we start putting paths on that. And you see now a few of the sentences that exist in the corpus of child. These are sentences spoken by parents to small children. You get all this mess of the different sentences. And it's in this space of all the spaghetti that you have to find your way.
But that's what you just built that. And so every sentence in Alice is now represented.
Now every sentence in child, and there are 100,000 sentences. Now I talk about the corpus of child.
Okay.
And
every sentence,
and the sentence
is
now
right
represented
there.
As a path.
Yeah.
Now it's very difficult to see your way around, and to see your way around, it's better to go along one of the paths, and then you represent it differently. So for instance, you begin is at the dog, is the same type of sentences, and then you add another one, and you add another one. Sorry for the noise in here. And eventually, it is this type of structure that we are looking for. And what we want to get is a pattern of that type that includes words, goes up to here, and there is some equivalence class of some other words that appears. These are the structures that we are after. And you see here again the same plotted I showed you before. We start out by looking for patterns that don't include equivalence classes. So
these are motifs with detours.
Now these are just motifs. These are just collocations.
Right now these are still motifs.
Now they are collocations, namely motifs of words or groups of words. So any two words that follow each other, New York would be in here.
No, but the previous example you had, where you had
down. Right. So now I want to explain how I get there.
Yeah.
So I start out by doing this graph, and then I add the patterns that I find as vertices in the graph. Okay. Now I do the following step of generalization. I take the graph and I move with some window along one of the paths. Eventually over all paths. And within this window, here it's a window of length 4. I allow entries and exits, but no entries at step number 1 or 2, only a slot is opened here. And the question is, how many paths do I have that include look there something too? Okay? So here you have, if you wish, you open up some wildcard, but you count which path goes to that.
Okay, so everywhere in the graph, which is on words, you take a window size 4,
I move,
and you're looking at the third slot, and you're trying to
right.
find out how many times are the are 1, 2, and 4 the same, but 3 is different.
I have now a structure of that type,
okay.
And I ask myself whether this structure is significant using the same type of statistical argument that I had before,
okay.
Which is now a little bit revised to include this possibility. Now, if the answer is that it is significant, then I define this as an equivalence class. So this is a generalization step, and it is already a generalization of the text, because if there is some other word if there is a word, I took the table to, I took the chair to is a sentence in the corpus, but I took the table to is not a sentence in the corpus if I stood here, okay? And by this this identification, I already made a generalization, and I produced sentences that were not there before.
I have a question, sir.
Yes.
If in the corpus we have, I took the giant frog to, giant frog is
not here.
Not here, but later. Okay.
not here. But that may appear here. Namely, I do a second iterative step where I allow existing equivalence class to appear already as elements. And I ask whether in a different slot in the same window, I have once again a combination that may be realized as an equivalence class. Okay? Now, if this passes a test and I declare it to be an equivalence class, I did once again a major generalization now, because these three sentences turn now into nine. So here I identified a pattern which includes one equivalence class. Now I know this equivalence class already. It is within my set of elements, okay? Mm-hmm. Now I identify another one and I define this as a new pattern, yes.
So I just want to make sure I understand. The second step has exactly the same form as the first step. It's not a different kind of operation.
Right.
It's just that your input sentences, because of the first step, are now the blue noun is, the red noun is, and the green noun is.
Okay.
Is that correct? So
yes.
Now, because blue, red, and green all appear with the before and noun is after, now you can equivalence class them. Is that the idea?
Right.
So you get now the adjective noun.
Noun, yes. Yep. But noun is a very specific noun. Namely, a specific set of nouns.
This set of three words.
Right, this set of three words.
Well, okay, fine.
Yes.
The furniture.
Right.
Is. Sorry, the blue furniture is, the red furniture is, the green furniture is.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm sure it follows by what you just said, but I wouldn't know how to answer my question. Suppose another noun appears, but it wasn't among these three. How does it get together with the other nouns?
Once I know that this equivalence class exists, it may appear also somewhere else in the corpus. This gives kind of a general picture of what is going on. It doesn't include all the details, but it kind of gives you the idea. You start out by forming patterns, like this combination far away forms a pattern. Then, as you go along and you run the whole procedure time and again, you form new patterns that include the old one. So for instance, this pattern includes number 67, but includes also an equivalence class, which has the words extremely or very. Everything which is underlined here is an equivalence class, not underlined is a pattern. And now you can read it the same way you read the parse tree. Namely, you have this pattern 120, it includes the equivalence class, you have to choose one of them, those in the It includes this pattern, you have to choose a pattern, it includes the word is, and the equivalence class 65, you choose one of the 65. And then this pattern, it includes the equivalence class, you choose one of here, and you choose both of those in here. And this is how you produce, again, the same sentence. And as you iterate it more, eventually you may reach a situation where the whole sentence is just replaced by one pattern, that is called then the root pattern, and you have a tree like that under this pattern. So the beginning sentence ends up being a tree, and the set of all sentences is becoming a set of three, like you wish a forest. Now each tree like that is written in terms of patterns and equivalence classes, so it's in fact a context-free grammar. A context-free grammar, however, without loops, namely it's written only as a tree, and I can write all these as a set of substitution like that, like in a context-free grammar. So I start with a set of sentences, 100,000, 1,000, whatever. I end up with 1,000 kind of trees like that, and there are three types of elements in here. The terminals, namely the original words, the patterns, and the equivalence classes. And patterns can be patterns of terminals, or patterns of patterns, or patterns of patterns and equivalence classes. Of the types that you can see here, it gets more and more complicated. And it's a set of all these trees which now represent the corpus in this implementation of our. Now, obviously, it includes all the original sentences, but it includes many more.
Right, okay, so I was going to say.
And now the question is whether this generalization is a valid one or not.
It's certainly not complete because it gives you only, it will not give you sentences of arbitrary length, right?
Definitely, that's
yeah.
correct.
That's as you said, there's no recursion in the context-free grammar. So
there is no recursion.
Brings up some mode.
We can then, there is a way of introducing recursion by hand, but this is later on. But
so the basic problem seems to be that if you've got noun, and you merge it with adjective noun, because they appear in the same context, you don't get a new thing back called noun. What you get back is something called supernoun, but supernoun only has one adjective. You could have adjective supernoun and merge take that phrase and get super duper noun, but you still wouldn't have adjective star.
We call
star
it P149.
Well, I'm taking the liberty of giving
okay.
it a nickname.
But you run out of vocabulary soon. And if you use the numbers...
No, because I have a recursive grammar, so I can go
okay.
noun, super noun, super duper noun, super duper hyper noun.
Okay.
You are out of order.
Good for you.
So how many...
Here's a more complicated example of a structure like that, yes.
But go back one slide, please, sir.
Yeah.
So you started with N sentences, and you now have M trees.
M trees, in fact, the number of trees is roughly the same
that's
as
right.
the number of sentences.
Okay.
And maybe that I will not be able to combine this 120 and 101 into 144, so maybe I have more. But basically, the number of trees is
okay.
of the order of the number of sentences.
That's right.
Now, some of these elements may appear also in trees that start from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So this type of forest has connected woods in it.
Right.
Okay? But they go only in one direction.
Right.
Thank you.
So I'm not seeing where in your process you can have units which have different numbers of words in them that are equivalent.
What do you mean?
Well, in other words, so you could have, Beth walked across the lawn or the dog walked across the lawn. Well, the dog and Beth, it should end up in the same equivalence class,
mm-hmm.
super, but I don't see where in your process you will.
Well, they have to appear more than in one sentence like that. I mean, that is the whole idea of Max. Namely, if they appear once or twice in the same context, that will not be enough.
Mm-hmm.
They have to, not in the same, sorry, I have to say that. They have to appear in some way together.
No, I don't understand.
Okay.
But I don't want to understand this. I mean, I understand you have, a given number of words, say three words, and you've gotten some super categories, and you can merge categories that have the same number of words. But I didn't see where in your process you could incorporate into the same category, say the phrase the dog, and then a verb, and then something else, appears lots, and Beth, da-da-da, appears lots. How do you ever conclude that Beth and the dog are part of a super family?
Because the dog has more words than Beth?
Yes.
That was the asked question I asked earlier.
Did
I don't know the answer, though. I couldn't tell the answer.
I don't claim that we will be able to find all possible structures
that
are logically...
But can you find this particular kind of structure?
I cannot guarantee that I will find a particular kind of structure. What I can guarantee is, on the test that I did, that in a machine learning sense, I have high accuracy.
Wait, we're just wondering what this is. I understand that.
In principle.
But is it possible? And you had an equivalence class that had table and chair and something else. Isn't it possible to have a two-word thing that's also equivalent to the one-word table?
What
oh,
about
yeah.
Can you have equivalence class
oh, yeah.
of patterns?
Of course.
Okay,
yeah.
I thought
you
that's
can.
What he said.
Yeah,
but
yeah definitely. Well, here I have examples only of equivalence classes that are equivalence classes of words, but there are equivalence classes of equivalence classes and of patterns, and I will show you structures like that. Okay, so, let's see if there's an example in here. Here you have an equivalence class that contains both words, namely terminals,
and
patterns. Okay.
So the pattern P49 could be the dog.
Yeah.
P49 in fact is
yeah.
E50.
Right.
So this answers the question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That answers. It answered mine, Mark. I might have usurped yours.
I see the E50, but how can an E50 and an E50 be?
Just back up and hold it from the example.
Jason and Sanjeev get it, and so that means we can ask them.
Yes.
Okay. How you can have an AE50, a ZE50, and
Mark,
that is for
look at P49. P49 is a dog. So let's
right.
say 50 was a dog.
Right.
So a dog is equivalent to Beth. So E64 permits either Beth
right.
or P49.
Right.
And
right.
P49 is A something, and the something could be dog. So A dog is equivalent to Beth.
But
is A dog equivalent to dog?
But
no.
But note that there are situations where E64 is included.
Not in the picture.
There are situations where E64 comes into play, and there are situations where E53 comes into play. Now, E53 is only people, and E64 may be other objects.
Uh-huh.
So this depends on where they are now in the final pattern of the sentence. And in fact, it may be that we have equivalence classes of only females and only males, and that will also come up. So it really depends then in the context of the sentence where the equivalence class appears. So you may have the same best in equivalence class 53 and in equivalence 64 and more and more. So this structure just evolves and goes. I mean, in that sense, it has a lot of flexibility because it introduces additional structure. Okay, so here is an example. Well, I will go over it very quickly now. How do we test ourselves? We test ourselves through a student-teacher process. Namely, we have either a given grammar that we look only, that we construct out of these sentences or each corpus, and we save a part of it for testing and a part for training, and then we do a precision recall test. Namely, we let the student generate new sentences and the teacher decide whether they are grammatical, and the other way around. And when I say grammatical, saying this recall, the demand is very stringent. We require that a sentence produced by the teacher is indeed, the whole sentence is captured within the structure of the student. This is an example of a simple context-free grammar with one loop, which after 6,400 sentences reached an accuracy which is already very high.
Can you just explain that evaluation again? I didn't catch it.
No.
Oh, I thought that is so clear. It's
I'm
sorry. I'm sorry. So basically, So the teacher generates a corpus of sentences.
Good.
The student is the audio student, the distilled syntax composed of significant patterns and equivalence classes. Okay? Then the teacher produces unseen sentences, and they are checked by the student, and the student says they appear in my structure or they don't appear.
Okay.
This is recall.
So the student can recognize the sentence.
Can recognize a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And the student produces new sentences, and the teacher says whether they are allowed or not allowed, grammatically. Okay? This is significant.
Okay. So for the student to recall the sentence, it has to be generable from the root of the CFG.
Right.
And who is your teacher? Is your teacher,
teacher.
A complete CFG of English? What is it?
The teacher.
Held out sentence.
The teacher may be a context-free grammar with a loop or with many loops even.
Well, in the example, in the evaluation you did,
I did a few.
Okay, good.
So one evaluation here, I show you an example of a simple context-free grammar generated by us. This is a simple set of rules. Now, we did it on the child's corpus, and I show you now results from the ATIS corpus. Okay? So ATIS is the Airline Transportation Information System. It consists of many sentences or utterances uttered by people who try to get tickets from airline agents. And one of these ATIS corpora has 13,000 sentences composed of 1,300 words. And there exists also a context-free grammar for ATIS that was written by hand by a group of people, and it includes a very large set of rules with many loops in them. And it achieves a recall of 45% only, and it's still considered good. Now, we worked on two things. We worked on the ATIS context-free grammar, namely to see how well we do with that. And we worked on the ATIS natural language, namely the 13,000 sentences. The artist context free grammar is in fact more complicated because it has a set of many rules that can generate a lot of things that are not grammatical. They are not grammatical, but nonetheless it generates. It has a good recall, but a very lousy significance. And to recapture it is difficult. That is what I am told.
What do you mean they're not grammatical? They're defined as grammatical, right?
No. You
but
generate.
Okay. It's a bad grammar.
It's a bad grammar.
They're grammatical in a formal mathematical sense of the word.
Oh yeah,
you
of
look
course.
And then you say,
okay, all right.
That's not English.
So here you see in this space of recall and precision how well we do. Now to do well, we need a large training set, and we also need a large set of learners. In that case, as I said, it's a very complicated context-free grammar. And I answered before one of the questions, we said that because we have a greedy algorithm, each student has his own idiosyncrasies depending on the way the sentence were presented to him or to her. Now, what we do is we take many learners that learn the same sentences only at a different order. And recall is now defined if the sentence generated by the teacher is recognized by one of the learners, and precision is defined by each sentence generated by the learners, whether it's recognized by the teacher, average over sentences.
So you're giving yourself the advantage in both cases.
Right. Why
right.
not?
Yeah. Well, I mean, a fairer thing to do if you want to use lots of learners is take the union of all their grammars.
Right.
So,
and we take.
You know, if you're, in other words, you should at least do it the same way for precision.
We try to do something like that, but it's not here yet.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
And these are the results that we obtain. Now, another experiment that we do is that we do it on artist natural language, namely 13,000 sentences. And then we take our Adios machine and ask whether the results, whether the sentences that it generates are considered to be grammatical. Now this is done since we cannot ask the corpus. The way it is done, sentences are generated both from the artist, taken from artist and from Adios, and are presented to psychology students in Cornell, and they are supposed to judge whether the sentence is grammatical or not. They don't judge the artist's natural languages being grammatical over an order of kind of 80%, and it is roughly within the same limit that also our sentences are judged as being grammatical. So we see it as a very good sign.
And that's a good sign of precision, but not of recall. Right?
Now, recall, I said that we achieve a recall of 40%, whereas artist content-free learner achieved 45%.
But that's 40% with a lot of learners or with one learner?
Is it with a lot of learners.
So any individual learner might have recall of 2%?
I don't know. I don't know the number.
Well, this is important.
Okay.
I mean, this is really important. Because you're giving yourself the advantage. I mean, anybody can make precision go up to 100% by itself. Anybody can make recall go up to 100% by itself.
It's, wow. There is an overlap between them. So they do more than 2%. But I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer for the average learner, but I can tell you the following thing. As I said, everything in here was done syntactically only. Now, we can do things also, we can help our algorithm with semantic rules. You saw already that equivalence classes had semantics in them. So if equivalence classes are given to the system to begin with as an aid in its development of itself, then we can increase this recall to an order of 60 or 65% in this particular example. But it's still the way I define it. Language model, we can work with it. I added these transparencies in here because that question came up yesterday and before. We can develop a language model in the following sense. You take a string and you ask, of course, what is the next word, and then you see if you have a match to that string in the Adios presentation and see what it will say in this case. If these are the predicted words, then it will say if they belong to an equivalence class, it will give them a weight of a half each. And then you can have also different matches in here. and you can have a, in that case, a prefix of length 6, but you can have some other prediction for a prefix of length 4, or maybe of a prefix or longer prefix if you started with a longer sentence to begin with. And we give weights to the different prefixes, namely the larger the prefix, the higher weight it has, and this defines the probability. And then we work on a training set of ATIS-2. This is the same that I mentioned before, the training set of ATIS-3. And the type of perplexity numbers that we get are very low, low compared to others that we found in the literature. Now, it may very well be that we don't have the latest numbers, and I would be happy to get some comments from the audience on that. And maybe as the last element, I want to show you results of a meta-analysis just because it is very cute. And we already said that patterns are patterns of patterns and equivalence are terminal. And altogether, we have 3 types of objects. So you can look at the spectrum of patterns that you get. Namely, you say, I look at all the patterns that I have, and I ask how many of them are 2 terminals, terminal equivalence class, etc. And this is done, we run it on 6 different, we take from the from a website called the Parallel Bible, 6 versions of the Bible in 6 different languages, and we apply it to all the 6 different languages. And this is the type of structure that we get.
Who are the languages that are the same? Swedish and Danish.
Are the same?
He's just being gone.
No, I mean, I'm not being sarcastic, but essentially.
The numbers are pretty similar.
They're pretty similar.
Pretty similar, but they're the same.
Not the same.
Okay. So you see that in all of them, a collocation of 2 words is, of course, very important. And that comes out. A collocation of 3 words is also very important. But the distribution is, of course, different. Now, this continues up to the highest structure available. But anyway, it can be put in a normalized fashion. And you can compare the different language by taking just the dot product. And now compare distances. And this is a comparison of the distances. And you are right.
They're
close.
They're close together, that's right.
But here, they turn out to be close together, not because of the words, but because of the context-free grammar. This is a difference in doing it this way than it is usually being done. And if we don't compare the vocabulary and ask which of the words are written the same way and have the same meaning. Here we compare what I showed before. I mean, these funny structures, this Lego plot, okay? And we get this result. So this is kind of cute. Well,
I'm trying to understand on the previous slide what the structures are. What is PE and, pattern.
You produce patterns, and patterns of patterns, etc. T is terminal, namely the original word.
Okay.
P is another pattern, and E is an equivalence
class. Thank you.
And you have basically all of them together.
Okay, now so you're learning things like, does the language have right branching structure? Do the syntactic trees have right branching structure? In which case, you would expect to see a lot of EPs and TPs, but not PTs and PEs, which would be left branching structure, for example.
For example.
Okay. Good. Okay, so I like this.
Yeah. Okay. I like the fact that you
probably didn't
mean
it.
Shouldn't
say no.
Okay.
I don't mean to add to it because I know you have to deal with them already. But if you could explain one more time, I got a bit confused about this picture.
Okay. We started out with.
I did follow.
We start out from here. So really we have all these words. This is kind of the original vocabulary, right? And then we have patterns, and patterns including patterns, and patterns including equivalence classes, etc. So now you have in your lexicon, you have a list of all the patterns and what they are composed of. So look at all possible patterns in your lexicon and ask how many of them are composed of just of two terminals, of other patterns, etc. So a pattern that is composed out of a pattern and an original word will be will add to the PT term in here. And if it's composed of out of an original word and a pattern, it will add to TP, etc. And the highest number is obtained for patterns that are composed just of two words, two consecutive words in the sentence. So these are the collocations, and also of three consecutive words. And that's true of all languages, including Chinese.
Purely syntactical similarity.
Purely, it's everything is purely syntactic.
So
and yeah, and this leads to this type of.
This is this is totally complementary to what I'm going to show in 20 minutes.
The organizers are geniuses, then.
They are. They are.
Well, we knew that.
It is because I have a purely lexical.
Yeah.
Plot exactly like this.
Exactly.
Right.
So I'm curious. I mean, obviously there are other things you could try. I mean, say you tried two of Dickens' novels.
Yeah.
Would they be similar? Could you, ideally, I mean, obviously they'd be much more similar in different languages.
Could you,
for example, reconstruct something about his, what order he wrote his books in?
Well, you can compare Dickens to Shakespeare, Dickens to Dickens, and Shakespeare. Find out if it's not written by another guy who was also called Shakespeare.
Actually, we're out of time.
So. Yeah, we're out of time. So
why did you finish up?
Yeah. There was one more element I wanted to say, and that is that the presentation of the final adios grammar is compressed compared to the original one. And we achieve, in fact, compression. And so I won't belabor this point anymore. I just leave this set of statements and the website. Okay.